Hello, and welcome to the Journal of Mormon History podcast. This is the inaugural episode of what is planned to be a quarterly podcast, with a new episode launching to coincide with the publication of each new issue of the journal. My name is Christopher Jones, and in addition to hosting the podcast, I serve as editor of the Journal of Mormon History, the flagship journal of the Mormon History Association, published in partnership with the University of Illinois Press. For more information on subscribing to the journal or submitting your work to be published, please visit mormonhistoryassociation.org or press.uillinois.edu. Each episode of the show will feature a brief rundown of all articles included in the latest issue of the journal, as well as a short conversation with one or more authors whose work is featured. Today, I am delighted to be joined by guests Michael Austin and Rachel Helps, co-authors of a fascinating article in the newly published issue entitled Great Books and True Religion, the Relief Society Literature Curriculum, 1914 to 1970. Before getting to that conversation, though, I want to share with listeners the other articles and essays included in this issue. And I want to note here that this issue marks the 50th anniversary of the Journal of Mormon History, which began publication in 1974. To that end, Volume 50, Issue 1, opens with a short forum on the past, present, and future of the Journal of Mormon History. Jesse Embry, my former co-editor at the journal, opens with an overview of the journal's beginnings and development over the last 5 decades. It appropriately honors and celebrates several of the past editors of the journal, including notably Levina Fielding Anderson, who edited the journal from 1991 until 2009, and worked to expand its length and scope, among other notable accomplishments. As many listeners may know, Levina sadly passed away late last year, and Jesse's essay appropriately honors her several contributions to the journal. Christopher Blythe, who served as co-editor of the journal with Jesse from 2020 to 2022, follows up Levina's short essay with his own advice from a past editor. A sort of love letter to the field of Mormon history, Chris offers advice to young scholars in the field hoping to make their contribution. I strongly recommend any and all graduate students and junior scholars in the field take the time to read his thoughts. I then conclude the 50th anniversary forum with a look at what lies ahead for the journal. I consider it a great honor and serious responsibility to assume editorship of JMH, and plan to build on the exceptional work of my predecessors in the position, and to ensure that the journal remains the preeminent place to publish and read and learn about the Mormon past, while nurturing the community's unique combination of academic researchers, independent historians, and others from all walks of life who participate in the field of Mormon history. For those of you interested in additional information about the 50th Anniversary Forum, Jesse, Chris, and I appeared on the latest episode of The Upside, the University of Illinois Press's podcast, to discuss the past, present, and future of JMH. That episode, as well as others from that podcast, are available at all podcast players. There are 4 articles published in this issue. The first, by John D. Beatty, is entitled Full of Life, Fun, and Fight: James Arlington Bennett, Correspondent, Forger, and Eccentric. It offers a helpful and corrective overview of the life and career of Bennett, a one-time correspondent of both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, whose penchant for lying and self-aggrandizement, Beatty explains, led eventually to the exposure of his true character and relegated him to the sidelines of any meaningful involvement with the Latter-day Saints. Beatty, a professionally trained genealogist, offers here a thorough and detailed assessment of Bennett's biography and the oft-overstated, if not outright fabricated, life story he sometimes presented to his associates. Among other things, Beatty's article serves as a caution to some Mormon scholars who have been fooled about Bennett's origins and motivations. Like early Mormon leaders, those scholars have, according to Beatty, erred in taking his statements too literally. Beatty's article is followed by a narrative, almost blow-by-blow account, of the Battle of Nauvoo from David L. Herron. The battle, fought over the course of 3 days in early September 1846, between a few hundred Mormon men and some 700 anti-Mormons, was, according to Herron, a real war with cavalry and infantry charges, prolonged gunfire, injury, death, and destruction. Taking advantage of several long, sequestered accounts of the episode only recently made available at the Church History Library, his article offers the most complete narrative of this story to date, making clear that far from being only a skirmish, the Battle of Nauvoo was marked by unrelenting cannonading and gunfire, in which the fate of Nauvoo literally hung in the balance. Shifting focus from the 19th century to the 20th, the final two articles in the issue offer important new insights into the history of literature and Latter-day Saints. In addition to the article we'll discuss with guests in just a moment, it also features Gabriel Gonzalez Nunez's assessment of the literary landscape for 20th century Spanish-speaking LDS poets. In spite of the large and growing number of native Spanish speakers in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints over the course of the 20th century, relatively little is known about Mormon literature in Spanish. In an effort to correct that imbalance and to recover the literary writings of Spanish-speaking saints, Nunez pored over little-known periodicals published in Mexico and Argentina, analyzed the poems, short stories, and other writings therein, and pieced together a relatively small but vibrant tradition that existed and persisted over the course of the 20th century. Books reviewed in this issue include the following: Caroline Klein, Mormon Women at the Crossroads, Global Narratives and the Power of Connectedness, reviewed by Elizabeth Heath; Christian Heimberger et al., Documents Volume 13 of the Joseph Smith Papers, reviewed by Glenn Leonard; F. Lamont Tolles, Grassroots in Mexico, Stories of Pioneering Latter-day Saints, reviewed by Barbara Morgan Gardner; John Gary Maxwell, The Last Called Mormon Colonization, Polygamy, Kinship, and Wealth in Wyoming's Bighorn Basin, reviewed by Jay Buckley; Adam Jortner, No Place for Saints, Mobs and Mormons in Jacksonian America, reviewed by Alexander Baugh; Gavin Feller, Eternity in the Ether, A Mormon Media History, reviewed by Benjamin Peters; Christine Elise Blythe, Christopher James Blythe and Jay Burton, editors, Open Canon, Scriptures of the Latter-day Saint Tradition, reviewed by Kimberly Matheson; Richard Turley and Barbara Jones Brown, Vengeance is Mine, The Mountain Meadows Massacre and Its Aftermath, reviewed by Thomas Alexander; and Richard Saunders, The 1920 Edition of the Book of Mormon, A Centennial Adventure in Latter-day Saint Book History, reviewed by Robin Scott Jensen. Hello, I'm Christopher Jones, editor of the Journal, and today I'm excited to welcome to the podcast guests Michael Austin and Rachel Helps, authors of a fascinating article in the newly published issue of the Journal titled Great Books and True Religion, The Relief Society Literature Curriculum, 1914 to 1970. Thank you for joining us today, Michael and Rachel.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having us on.
Before we discuss your article, why don't you each briefly introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Rachel Helps. I'm the Wikipedian in residence at the Harold Bealey Library here at BYU. And I'm also studying Mormon literature in graduate school right now.
And I'm Michael Austin, and I am beginning my third month as the provost at Snow College in Ephraim, Utah. I moved here from Indiana in October. And when I'm not provosting, I try to study Mormon literature and the history of how literature impacted Mormonism at various points in its development.
Wonderful. And you have a new book out, Michael. Would you like to plug that here?
Yeah, this is actually, it's a book about the Book of Mormon. It's called The Testimony of Two Nations, How the Book of Mormon Reads and Rereads the Bible. And this is an attempt to situate the Book of Mormon in the canonical context of the Bible and the Book of Mormon together, and the roughly saying that the Book of Mormon relates to the Christian Bible in a very similar way that the New Testament relates to the Hebrew Bible. And it uses a method called canonical criticism to kind of build out those connections.
Wonderful. And that book is published by the University of Illinois Press that also publishes the Journal of Mormon History. I'm excited to have you both here to share with listeners more about your article today. To get us started, why don't you tell readers what the article is about and ultimately what it argues?
The saints in the 20th century took the instruction to study out of the best books very seriously. The literature lessons in Relief Society started in 1914 and became more official over time. The formal lessons were part of the curriculum for teaching Relief Society. It was a way to make information about classic and contemporary literature more accessible for sisters who couldn't go to college and their parents. And by making it like a book club through the church, leaders were trying to prevent the cliquishness that friends-only literary clubs that were popular in the 1910s and 20s could foster. At least, that was the initial vision. In 1940, J. Reuben Clark told the Relief Society to limit their cultural work to the promotion of faith and testimony, and the lessons shifted in 1943 to focus on devotional aspects of Scripture. As the church internationalized, literature lessons became less viable, and they petered out into the cultural refinement lessons.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Before we get into the kind of nuts and bolts of the argument and evidence that you lay out here, I'm curious about how the two of you came to take an interest in this subject, how you discovered these Relief Society literary lessons, and in particular, how the two of you came to work together as co-authors.
Well, I met Rachel about a year and a half ago at the Mormon History Association conference in Logan, and we talked for quite a while about some work that she was doing on the development of Esperanto in Mormonism and at BYU, and that, I believe, is an article that will soon be coming out also in the Journal of Mormon History. And we talked a lot about Mormon literature and kind of struck up a correspondence. And then about 6 weeks later, I came out to Utah again to attend the Sunstone Symposium, and Rachel invited me down to talk with her and a couple other librarians about Mormon literature. On the way down, I went to the Deseret Industries in Provo, and I had been looking for some books there. The Out of the Best Books series that I remember being in my house when I was growing up, and I remember my mother teaching out of. So I managed on the way down here to buy all five of those for about a dollar each at the DI in Provo. And when we were talking, I said I would be really interested in writing an article about this. And that was really the focus of the article, was the Out of the Best Books series. And I figured it was just so amazing that as far back as 1966, the Relief Society was teaching literature lessons. So I started getting into the literature, and I saw that there were other lessons in 1965. And I just went all the way back and I found that they went all the way back to 1914. I also found out that Bruce Clark, who was one of the two editors of that series, had a memoir that he wrote that was typeset that was in the BYU library. I was in Indiana. I couldn't access the BYU library. So I wrote to Rachel and asked her if she would just go in and take some pictures. And she did. And what I found out is that she's a very dogged researcher who's able to find all sorts of amazing sources. And I asked her if she would be willing to collaborate with me on this project.
Oh, yeah. Well, what Mike didn't mention is that our correspondence started over chess games. Over the pandemic, I got a little bored and I got really into chess. And I was just looking for people to play chess with me. And Mike graciously offered to play against me, although in our win-loss record, he has slightly more wins than I do. But so, yeah, if you're looking to find people to work with, you should start playing chess, really.
I love that this collaboration just got nerdier than I even initially suspected. So that's fantastic. And I'll thank you. I first purchased the Out of the Best Books series as a missionary in Tempe, Arizona, about 20 years ago when I found them for about that same price as you found them a couple of years ago at the DI down there. And so I was delighted when reading this to have a little bit of history about those volumes and where they came from. So thank you.
Yeah, that was going to be the whole article. And it just got bigger and bigger because we discovered that the Relief Society has been having really college-level literature courses from 1914 through 1971 and just taught an amazing array of literature, what you would find in college survey classes of literature.
Well, I'm glad that you pushed further, though, because ultimately what the article became was a case study illustrating, I think, a broader tension that runs throughout much of Mormon history between competing ideas over truth, the spiritual and the secular, and ultimately the meanings of Mormonism, in this case, in the 20th century. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So ever since I've been affiliated with BYU as a student or in any other way, there's been a sign out in front that says, the world is our campus. And ever since that sign has been there, there have been malcontents and sarcastic individuals who have flipped that around and said, the campus is our world. I did that. I think Rachel did that. My father did that. And that really illustrates the two tensions that we're going for. There's the idea of an expansive Mormonism that says everything is Mormonism. And this was the Orson F. Whitney view. Math is Mormonism, and literature is Mormonism, and Dante, even Byron is Mormonism. That was a direction we actually cut out. There was a whole debate about can you be a good Mormon and like Byron. and then there's the sort of Mormonism is the world, and stay focused on the gospel and building testimony. And that's really where J. Reuben Clark came from in the 1940s and dramatically changed these Relief Society lessons. The title, Great Books and True Religion, actually alludes to a fairly famous essay by Eugene England called Great Books or True Religion, where he explores the tension between the literature curriculum and the gospel, and that tension has always been there. So we put the "and" in there specifically to focus on the fact that for about the first, 20, 25 years of this literature curriculum, they were reading Ibsen and Byron and Shelley and Shakespeare and had just really the lessons, which were all printed in the Relief Society magazine, had this amazingly expansive view of what the gospel meant. And then as the church became more correlated, that shrank into a view that judged everything by the tenets of the gospel. And that just produced, we thought, a fascinating tension in these lessons that played out in a lot of interesting ways over 50 years of consistent lessons. I also want to say that we originally included a full appendix with all 500 lessons and the books that were used, and y'all wouldn't let us keep that in. But it does exist, and if anyone wants it, email me. I've got it.
That's awesome. So beyond its historical contribution, I was struck while reading your article by the ongoing relevance of that research to contemporary debates within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Maybe debates isn't even the right word, between competing tensions within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or perhaps the legacies of those earlier tensions down to the present. Nevertheless, you both do a really good job of situating the ebbs and flows of this Relief Society literary curriculum and kind of the President Clark's pushing back on it and others supporting it within these very specific historical contexts. The results of particular personalities and processes in early and mid-20th century Mormonism. And along the way, you introduce and discuss a number of really quite interesting individuals and personalities. Michael, you mentioned J. Reuben Clark, famed First Presidency member and conservative reformer. But others mentioned in the text that you discuss at length may be less familiar to readers. Is there a person discussed in the article that you found particularly compelling or significant to the story that you tell?
Yes. So, well, I mean, you may have heard of Alice Louise Reynolds, who founded the literary department at BYU and supported a lot of the library's growth at BYU. But she was kind of like the secret puppet master behind the whole thing. Because if you look at the authors of the literary curriculum, like almost all of them were connected to her in some ways. And I have a relationship chart between Alice Louise Reynolds and all of these people. And it's like, I feel like I'm that guy in the GIF with the red string who's guys, it's all connected. No, so Faye Tarlock was one of her students. And she was lifelong friends with Helen Camlin Starg, who shared an office with Alice Louise Reynolds. And Brighton Jacobs was also one of her students. And then Elsie Carroll and Anna B. Hart, they were part of her fan clubs, the Alice Louise Reynolds fan clubs. That there were multiple chapters, guys, because people just loved her that much. And Harrison R. Merrill was also one of her colleagues. And she's like the main influence here. She's the mastermind behind it all. And I did find out some interesting things about other people, like Faye Allerton Tarlock. She, I got out her papers, and it turned out she had written a short story and a play in the polygamy era Mormonism, and they were just like never published. I'm like, this is really interesting. And anyway, I have some more tidbits. Should I just go through them all?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Please.
Oh, yes. Faye Tarlock had this really cute story about Alice Louise Reynolds. And I'm actually collecting Alice Louise Reynolds stories right now because together with two of my library colleagues, we're going to be publishing the selected works of Alice Louise Reynolds through BCC Press.
Fantastic.
Yes. So this is from the Faye Tarlock papers, and she writes a tribute to Alice Louise Reynolds. She talks about how she was a legend before she even entered high school. She was a power in the university, and when she spoke at devotionals or at strictly girls' meetings, we listened respectfully with not a little awe. And she goes on to talk about how she was taking a theology class from Alice Louise Reynolds, and at the end, they all had to bear their testimonies. And she was like, well, maybe I'll just be quiet and no one will notice. And Alice Louise was like, well, if you don't want to bear your testimony, you can give a little talk about any subject you want. And she decided to talk about Browning. And I chose mornings at seven, the heavens dew pearled, et cetera, ending God's in his heaven, all's right with the world as my theme. Confident she would be impressed. Impressed she was not. She saw through me clearly and told me that while she firmly believed God was in his heaven, not all was right with the world. So, yeah, that was another interesting thing I found in the research.
Just to kind of add to what Rachel is saying, finding out the authors of these lessons from 1914 to 1943 was an enormous amount of detective work. We had to go through the Relief Society minutes. We had to go through all of the issues of the Relief Society magazine to find out the authors. And we were able finally to piece them all together. In 1943, J. Reuben Clark made the decision that all lessons had to be signed. So it was very easy to piece them together after that. And it is probably of some interest to note that almost all of the lessons before 1943 were written by women. Mm-hmm. After 1943, not a single lesson was written by a woman for the Relief Society magazine.
Wow. Wow. I love that peek behind the research curtain there, knowing the sort of nitty-gritty research and detective work that went into that and identifying those authors. So thank you.
We were very fortunate that the church released the Relief Society minutes about a month before we started writing the article.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah, Mike OCR'd all of the PDFs, and I was just like, I'm going to go fishing for something, a little full-text search on something. Oh, man, it was just so much fun.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Building on this, was there anything surprising that you encountered in the course of your research?
Oh, so in the Bryant S. Jacobs memoirs, he's one of the authors of the Literary Lessons, and he talked about in the Wilkinson era, there was the whole spy ring controversy, you know, and he was one of eight faculty chosen by Wilkinson to be spied on. And he said, no, this wasn't in his memoirs. It was in the oral history interview. He called this a great honor.
He did 14 years of lessons. He's the largest single lesson writer.
Okay.
And he was the president of the BYU chapter of the American Association for University Professors.
Okay. And he was an English professor here.
He was an English
BYU.
Professor. Most of the lessons were written by English professors or faculty members with degrees from major prestigious universities, all the way back to 1920, Alice Louise Reynolds.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So earlier, Michael, you mentioned that this curriculum, as initially envisioned, was a pretty expansive view of British and American literature,
yes.
of English language literature.
They actually used the textbooks that colleges were using at the time for literature survey courses. Those were textbooks purchased for these lessons.
And it's significant that Alice Louise Reynolds was writing about American literature in like the first half of the 20th century when people were like, didn't think American literature was cool enough to study at a university setting.
Well, yeah.
She was already there.
She's the best. One thing that I was really surprised by when I read your article was the inclusion of at least one African-American author.
Yes.
That seems to be a pretty radical act, regardless of where this curriculum was being published in the early 20th century, but especially in a Latter-day Saint-owned and operated magazine to include the work of Paul Laurence Dunbar, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it included a lot of things that I was a little bit surprised by. It included the poetry of Edna St. Vincent Millay, which was really quite shocking. And there's a little side drama that we ended up not including about Alice Louise Reynolds. Edna St. Vincent Millay came to Salt Lake, and Alice Louise Reynolds tried to get her to BYU, but it didn't work out. But there's evidence of her trying to make that happen. Probably the play that surprised me most, or the work that surprised me most, was Ibsen's A Doll's House,
okay.
which is about a woman leaving a marriage. And it was there. It was in one of the Alice Louise Reynolds lessons and was fully discussed and talked about in the magazine and one presumes in the classes.
How interesting. And these bits and pieces of evidence speak to this tension that you introduced earlier, that these women like Alice Louise Reynolds are advocating, are embracing, are articulating a view of Mormonism that is expansive, that sort of looks at a play or a short story or a poem that deals with a seemingly controversial topic that you may not think would be sort of standard lesson fare in a Latter-day Saint setting, and embraces this as, no, this has valuable lessons for Latter-day Saint women to learn.
And then a little bit later, in the late 1960s, we have Bruce Clark complaining that the Correlation Committee wouldn't let him publish Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, because it involved violence at the end. And he is, in his own journal, he says that that it's really hard to teach ideas when everything has to be positive.
Yeah, yeah.
So we get both of those directions pulling here.
Fantastic. And these are just a couple of the examples that you all share throughout the course of the article. And I don't want to give any more. I want to leave listeners interested in going and interested enough to go and actually read the article in its entirety. In fact, I want to encourage them to go do that, along with the several other excellent articles that appear in this issue of the Journal of Mormon History. If you're not already a subscriber, you can become one at either mormonhistoryassociation.org or press.uillinois.edu. The journal is available both in print and digitally. And before we depart, I want to thank our guests once more for coming on the podcast and sharing more about their research today. Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Is there anything either of you would like listeners to know before we sign off?
One more thing I would like to say is that the Relief Society literature lessons were once a month in a rotation.
Okay.
One day a month was sort of working business of the Relief Society. There are a similarly fascinating set of lessons on theology and on social work. And Amy Brown Lyman did the social work lessons that I'm not qualified to write about, but to anybody out there looking for a project, both of those, the social work and the theology lessons, are just as fascinating as the literature lessons, and those are articles that also need to be written.
Fantastic. Thank you. I love that.
I'm happy to be on the podcast. Also, my article on the Mormon Esperanto Society is also going to be in Journal of Mormon History, so look out for that. It's going to be super interesting, too. Both of these articles.
These are wonderful. Thank you. And please feel free to plug any and all of your work on this podcast. I'm looking forward to the publication of that as well. Well, thank you both once more. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us today.
This concludes our inaugural episode of the Journal of Mormon History podcast. Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please subscribe, share with your friends, and leave us a rating and review. We'll be back soon with another episode. Thanks to Michael Austin and Rachel Helps for joining me on the show, to Emily Peterson, Laura Greco, and Emma Griffin for research and editorial assistance with this issue and episode, and to Blair Hodges and Joseph Stewart for production help. I'm Christopher Jones, and this is the Journal of Mormon History podcast.